KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The White House freeze on funding has stopped work by pro-democracy groups around the world. That means safe houses for activists in authoritarian countries are suddenly closed.
They said thank you for everything that you did. Thank you for saving our lives. And we hope we will survive.
And what a wild few weeks for the NBA and a blockbuster trade could mean for the playoffs. Plus, in a new movie about feuding Irish farmers, sheep herding gets the thriller treatment. It's Sunday, February 16th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in the Middle East, his first trip there as the nation's top diplomat. He's there for talks about the future of Gaza. NPR's Hadil El-Shelchi reports from Tel Aviv.
On the table, a plan for a post-war Gaza. Marco Rubio met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on his first trip to the region as U.S. Secretary of State.
And I also thanked him for America's unequivocal backing for Israel's policy in Gaza in moving forward.
President Donald Trump's proposal shocked the Arab world when he said he wanted to displace the population of Gaza to other countries and redevelop the strip under U.S. ownership. Rubio is next traveling to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, where he says he's willing to hear alternative options to Trump's plan. This comes in the last stages of phase one of a shaky ceasefire that has seen 19 Hamas-held Israeli hostages freed and over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees released from Israeli jails. Hadil El-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Justice Department last week ordered federal prosecutors to move to dismiss corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Several prosecutors resigned over that decision. A few days later, Adams met with Border Czar Tom Homan and agreed to allow immigration agents access to the prison on Rikers Island. Homan said the two events are not related, that he had been seeking Adams' cooperation for months.
I've not asked his officers to be immigration officers. I'm not going to push them to enforce immigration law. I told him I want to arrest the bad guy. I want to arrest the public safety threats. I want to get Rikers Island so we can get the public safety threat before they're released to the street. I want his help, especially the NYPD intelligence unit.
Homan was interviewed on CNN's State of the Union. Heavy rain in the southeast has led to flooding and high water rescues. At least one person is confirmed dead in Kentucky, where the governor says President Trump has approved an emergency disaster declaration. At the same time, Southern California is cleaning up after its own heavy rain last week. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Rain over burn scars led to mudslides trapping cars in the Los Angeles area. The fire department responded, and a member had his vehicle swept off the road and into the ocean by debris flow, according to a spokesman. Mud has even seeped into homes, including Jill Forder's near Pasadena.
Oh my God, this is so much worse than I ever could have imagined.
That same system moved eastward, says forecaster Bob Oravec.
It redeveloped and was responsible for all the heavy rain that occurred across parts of Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky.
Kentucky's governor says historic flooding closed hundreds of roads. By Sunday, winds were picking up all along the east coast, bringing the risk of outages. And in the northern plains, Arctic air is bringing life-threatening cold into the negative 30s. Amy Held, NPR News.
This is NPR News. A 14-year-old boy has been killed and five people wounded in a knife attack in southern Austria. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
Police in Villach, a town near Austria's border with Slovenia and Italy, say the suspect is a 23-year-old Syrian asylum seeker who was detained at the scene. Austria's interior minister said the perpetrator was linked to the Islamic State group. The attack took place on Saturday afternoon near the town's main square. A delivery worker, also a Syrian man, who had witnessed the attack as he was driving by, deliberately rammed his truck into the suspect. Police say this prevented more injuries. Police say the suspect had a temporary residence permit and was waiting a decision on his asylum application. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Munich.
In the U.S., Georgia's Port of Brunswick has become the nation's busiest port for autos and heavy equipment. For member station WABE, Marlon Hyde reports.
The Port of Brunswick handled more than 2 million tons of auto and heavy equipment last year and also led the country in vehicle cargo exports like cars, trucks, and buses at 600,000 tons, according to USA Trade Online. This comes after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore last March that led to cargo being diverted to ports across the East Coast. Port officials say they're expanding capacity as auto manufacturers are looking to do more of their business through Georgia. Construction on a new berth that can handle larger vessels carrying auto imports is expected to start this summer. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
Amazon workers at a warehouse in North Carolina have rejected joining a union. The vote was nearly 3-1 against unionizing. Amazon is among NPR's recent financial supporters. And I'm NPR's Noor Aram in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. This weekend, President Trump posted this online. He who saves his country does not violate any law. The most common attribution of that statement is to Napoleon, though it's not certain the French emperor ever said it. The line is reminiscent of something another U.S. president said. But first, let's welcome NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Good morning, Deepa.
Hey, good morning.
So I'm thinking of this famous line from Richard Nixon.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
He said that to David Frost in 1977, and now we're seeing President Trump test that theory, right, as he and Elon Musk sweep through the federal workforce.
I mean, yeah, that's right. So there have been these massive sweeps of cuts to the federal workforce, and that's part of Trump and Elon Musk, who leads the Department of Government Efficiency, their goal to cut the size of the federal government. And this week, you know, Elon Musk appeared in the Oval Office answering questions from reporters. That was very unusual. And in that same event, Trump signed an executive order outlining how federal agencies should implement the DOGE-led reduction in workforce for federal agencies. And probationary workers who are recent hires are the ones being targeted. The problem, Aisha, though, in all of this is that there has been pretty much little to no transparency about how Elon Musk is going about doing any of this. I mean, literally, right before I got on air with you, I went to the DOGE government website, and under the tab that says savings, it says receipts coming over the weekend. There haven't been any receipts posted at this point. And in the meantime, as you can imagine, there have been a lot of blocks from federal judges and courts this week. 14 states have sued Elon Musk and DOGE and the president, saying that these cuts to government spending are unconstitutional.
Yes, and the nation's governors are coming here to Washington this week for a meeting of the National Governors Association, so that's probably going to be a big subject of discussion. Deepa, J.D. Vance also just made his first international trip as vice president, and you reported on it. What kind of impression did he make?
Yeah, Vance's speech really stood out to me this week because he was in Munich at the Munich Security Conference, which is an annual gathering. He's standing on European soil and was essentially scolding Europe. He said their biggest problem as a continent was not China or Russia, but themselves. He brought up examples of what he says is censorship of conservative and right-wing views. He downplayed the impact of Russian interference in democratic elections, and he was was critical of limits on hate speech and disinformation spreading online. And the timing of all of this is actually really critical because he said all of this just weeks before some countries in Europe, like Germany and Romania, are holding critical elections, ones where far-right parties and candidates have become more popular. And I was talking to one expert who said if a European leader had made a speech like this in the U.S. before a U.S. election, the blowback would have been immense. And you know, the response from some European leaders has been critical. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke out against Vance's comments after his remarks in Munich and said that he just rejected them.
Ukraine was top of mind in Munich this past week, and now you have Trump administration negotiators reportedly heading to Saudi Arabia. What do we think those talks are going to look like?
Right. So this week, Trump held a call with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. It was very lengthy. And afterwards, he also held a call with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. And he said both leaders want peace. And he said that he would likely have some kind of a first meeting with Putin in Saudi Arabia. The details around that are not entirely clear. But what has concerned some people, though, is that the Trump administration has already kind of, you know, said that it's, quote, unrealistic for Ukraine to join NATO, which is something that Ukraine has been repeatedly asking for. They say it's critical to prevent future attacks from Russia. And the U.S. has also said that Ukraine probably won't get its 2014 borders back. And Zelensky, you know, was on NBC's Meet the Press this morning, and he said that he hopes President Trump is negotiating in good faith. He also said Ukraine would not survive without military support from the U.S., and he said he believes Putin will wage a war against NATO. And I will just say Trump this week also offered some other comments about Russia. He says that he thinks Russia should be let back into the G7 group of nations. That was previously called the G8 before Russia was kicked out in 2014 for annexing Crimea. And Trump says that it would be helpful to have Russia back. So there's been a lot of elements of that conversation that have been added this week.
That's NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Deepa, thanks.
Thank you.
A White House order to freeze funding has stopped practically all U.S. government work supporting democracy, human rights, and press freedom around the globe. For the world's most powerful democracy, this is unprecedented. The order has forced pro-democracy organizations, which were created by Congress in the first place, to furlough most of their employees, close overseas offices, and halt hundreds of projects. NPR's Frank Langfitt is following the story and is with us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Aisha.
So take us to the start of all of this.
Yeah, and you know, several weeks ago, as people would remember, President Trump, he issued that executive order suspending all foreign aid. It's, as we've reported, it affected USAID, but also these other organizations, such as the National Endowment for Democracy, which is known around here in D.C. as the NED. It's had to suspend grants that it makes in 100 countries. Another organization, National Democratic Institute, has had to put two-thirds of its Washington-based staff on leave, and they're in the process of closing down more than half of their offices abroad.
And what's Trump's rationale for halting this funding?
Well, the administration says it needs 90 days to review the programs to make sure that they fit with the President's America First agenda. And people in the Trump administration have attacked some of these organizations. As Deepa was saying, talking about Elon Musk, you know, he, without any evidence, has called the National Endowment for Democracy a scam and an evil organization. Some conservative think tanks here in town says the NED, as it's known, meddles in the internal affairs of other countries. But by contrast, the NED says it's out there, you know, fighting for democracy and freedom in the world's most authoritarian countries. And leaders of some of the human rights group that get money from the NED, that is supported by the NED, said this funding freeze is just really a gift to dictators in Russia and China. And one of them told me a couple days ago, quote, Xi Jinping must be laughing his butt off.
So how is this playing out on the ground overseas?
Yeah, let me give you an example from USAID, which also promotes democracy abroad. They've been sending money to a local foundation in Thailand called Manusha, and this organization oversees safe houses for people who are on the run from authoritarian regimes like Cambodia. And these kinds of people are targeted inside Thailand. I'll give you an example. Last month, Cambodian opposition politician who was assassinated there. Now, without USAID funding, these safe houses are now closing, leaving about 35 people on their own. This morning, Aisha, I actually spoke to one of them who's living in a safe house. He's a member of an outlawed Cambodian opposition party, and he and his wife and his three kids, they're going to have to leave next month. And he's really worried that it's going to be that much easier for Thai police to find and arrest him. And of course, he asked us not to use his name for his own safety. But this is how he said he felt when he first learned that there would be no more funding and he'd have to leave the safe house.
I think my heart is broken. My soul is out of my body.
I think my heart is broken, he says.
Frank, the U.S. has supported these efforts and these pro-democracy organizations for many decades. And as we said, Congress founded them, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, Congress created the National Endowment for Democracy and its sister organizations. This was back in the early 1980s, and the idea was to strengthen democratic institutions around the world, and support was bipartisan. Now, this was inspired, Aisha, in part by a really famous speech by President Ronald Reagan to the British Parliament in 1982.
If the rest of this century is to witness the gradual growth of freedom and democratic ideals, we must take actions to assist the campaign for democracy. We must be staunch in our conviction that freedom is not the sole prerogative of a lucky few, but the inalienable and universal right of all human beings. The objective I propose is quite simple to state: to foster the infrastructure of democracy.
And Aisha, the Trump administration is now trying to dismantle that infrastructure.
You've been talking to people who work for these organizations. Why do they think the Trump administration is targeting them?
Well, these people say the Trump administration doesn't really believe the U.S. should be in the business of spreading or defending democracy abroad. And another element that they say is payback, because a lot of people who work in these organizations are Democrats.
Is there any chance the money might start flowing again?
Yeah, it could. You know, there's some recipients of foreign aid sued the government. And last week, a federal judge ordered the administration to temporarily lift the funding freeze and told the government that by this Tuesday, it has to explain how it's complying with the order. Of course, the longer, you know, Aisha, any organization has little or no money, the more likely it is to collapse and die.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Frank, thanks so much.
Good to talk, Aisha.
Later today on All Things Considered.
Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Robert Frost, famous for that poem and others, has been dead for 62 years. A recently discovered Frost poem from 1918 has just been published for the first time. It's called Nothing New. Learn more about it later by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Kentucky's governor says President Trump has approved an emergency disaster declaration because of heavy rains and dangerous flooding. Officials report at least one person died. The French foreign minister says France will host a summit of European leaders tomorrow to discuss the war in Ukraine. U.S. officials have indicated the European nations will not be part of any negotiations. And the death toll is rising in India after a stampede at a train station last night. Officials now say at least 18 people died. Many of them were Hindu pilgrims traveling to a festival. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in the Middle East. Today it's Israel and a meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On the table, plans for a post-war Gaza. The visit comes less than 2 weeks after Netanyahu met with President Trump in the White House. NPR's Hadil Al-Shawchi is in Tel Aviv and joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you.
This is the first visit for Rubio to the region in his new role. What do we know about his conversations with Netanyahu?
Well, at least at the press conference afterwards, Netanyahu gave Rubio a big hug, welcomed him to Jerusalem, and then really gushed about Israel's relationship with the U.S.
President Trump is the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. And the visit in Washington reflected that in every way, and your visit here reflects it in every way.
We know that the main thing they talked about was what a post-war Gaza should look like. I mean, they didn't disclose much of what they said today, but President Donald Trump's proposal is to displace Palestinians from Gaza, move them to other countries, mainly, you know, Jordan and Egypt, and then start rebuilding the strip under U.S. ownership. Now, that plan really shocked the Arab world. They rejected it. But then Rubio is saying, look, this is the proposal Trump is making right now, and he's telling Arab countries, if you have better ideas, we'll hear them. So Rubio's next stops on this trip are to Saudi Arabia and then onto the United Arab Emirates. That's where Arab leaders are supposed to hash out any other options to Trump's plan. By the way, it's also kind of important to note that it wasn't immediately clear if Rubio was going to meet with any Palestinian officials at all on this visit.
Anything else was brought up during this meeting?
Yeah, so Rubio also said that the U.S. was keeping an eye on the leaders of Lebanon and Syria to disarm militants in their countries, and then he turned to Iran.
It is the single greatest source of instability in the region. Behind every terrorist group, behind every act of violence, behind every destabilizing activity.
I mean, Rubio also called on the region's allies to combine their forces to make sure Israel stays safe. And then, you know, just as Rubio arrived here, a shipment of heavy bombs from the U.S. that were delayed by former President Biden also arrived in Israel.
And this is all happening during a shaky ceasefire with Hamas that almost collapsed last week, right?
Yeah, that's right. So yesterday, three more Israeli hostages, all civilian men, one with dual American-Israeli citizenship, were released. And that was in exchange for over 360 Palestinian prisoners and detainees held in Israeli jails. This was the sixth exchange, which, like you said, almost didn't happen. Hamas said it was going to delay the release because of alleged violations by Israel. Israel denied those violations. And the first phase actually expires at the beginning of March. An Israeli official who's familiar with the talks, but he couldn't speak publicly about them, told NPR that neither side has actually sat down to talk about what phase two would look like. And those negotiations were supposed to start a week ago. The official also said that Israel is planning to press for more hostages to be released this week. There are 73 hostages held by Hamas in Gaza right now, and Israel believes almost half are dead already.
That's NPR's Hadil Al-Shawchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
While some of you were preoccupied with the end of the NFL season last week, the NBA was making history. Teams are generally pretty busy in the time leading up to early February, when they have to finish up their mid-season trades. But this year, the trading period blew past busy and turned headlong into chaos, with some of the league's biggest stars getting shuffled from one franchise to another. And we have NBA reporter Dave Dufour from The Athletic here with us to tell us how they're doing. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here. I love NPR. Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with the trade of the year, maybe the decade. The Dallas Mavericks gave up one of the league's most promising players ever, Luka Doncic, the 25-year-old star from Slovenia, to the Los Angeles Lakers. How has that worked out for the Lakers in the past week?
I would say that it's mixed. Game one, everything looks great. The Lakers are hitting a lot of shots. The second game, they go to Utah, and they just looked flat and a bit lifeless. But Rob Pelinka, the GM of the Lakers, when he sat there with Luka Doncic on the stage in the introductory press conference, basically said this was a gift. So I think that everyone in Lakerland is pretty happy right now.
Dallas got Anthony Davis in return, which is not too shabby, right? A 10-time NBA All-Star. But fans didn't like saying goodbye to Doncic. And I take it they're still mad about it. I've seen a lot of, like, blow up on social media about this.
Yeah, you know, these sports teams now have sold fans on, you know, hey, be with us for the good times, but also stick with us during the hard times. They sell hope to these guys. And Luka Doncic, the Dallas Mavericks had to go through a couple of bad years, and their fans stuck around, and then they landed Luka Doncic in the draft, and this was the hope that they had been sold, and then it's a bit of a rug pull.
With Doncic being such a star, why would the Mavericks make this trade to the Lakers?
Well, there's a few reasons. Mavericks GM Nico Harrison has come out and said that the culture that they want to have in the Mavericks is about defense, accountability, being in shape, and essentially just throwing Luka Doncic under the bus as not being those things. You know, there is a financial part of this, and I think that that's where the fans really feel betrayed, because you didn't trade him because he wasn't good. You didn't trade him because he asked to leave. You traded him because of financial reasons, and then sort of are covering it up with this, he doesn't work out hard, he's not in shape. Which,
oh, yeah, I saw that. He had put on some weight or something.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it may be true, but he just dragged that team to the finals on one leg. So it just comes off a little bit hollow. And I think for fans, they feel extremely turned off and just unheard.
All of this seems like really exciting. It's a lot of action. Is it good for the league that a player the caliber of Luka Doncic can be traded mid-season like this? Is the chaos a good thing?
No, I don't think so. I actually personally feel like this trade is a bit nihilistic. The GM of the Dallas Mavericks, Nico Harrison, even said so in a press conference, like he's not going to be there in 10 years. So what does he care, essentially? And I don't think that that's a good way for a sports league to operate. By moving players all the time, by players moving all the time, you really have robbed NBA fans of the experience that a lot of us grew up with. I mean, I think that a little bit of sports stability is actually good.
That's Dave Dufour. He's the host of the Athletic NBA Daily podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know when you see a movie you can't shake, so you just have to talk about it? The new movie Bring Them Down is one of those. It's set in Ireland. Think harsh and isolated, not green and romantic. The setup seems simple. Neighboring families raise sheep for a living. Both families have difficult fathers and only children who are sons. Then two sheep belonging to the O'Shays maybe turn up dead on the Keeley's land. And let's just say a feud kicks off that's been simmering for generations. Bring Them Down is written and directed by Christopher Andrews. And do I ever want to talk to him about it? Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I like that. I'm going to use that.
So this movie was first pitched to me by a colleague who described it as like a livestock thriller. And I'm thinking like, what is a livestock thriller?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's this feud between two families that live cheek to jowl and at the bottom of this mountain and have these difficulties. But on the top of the mountain, they share that space and their animals live next to each other. And this idea of a collective responsibility, it's sort of examining people that have a complex relationship both in their work and then home lives too.
To get a flavor, let's play a scene from early in the movie when the two sons of these families come into contact. Jack Keeley, played by Barry Keoghan, says he found the two dead rams. Michael O'Shea, played by Christopher Abbott, is trying to get more information.
Can I see them?
No, you can't.
Why? Do they have any symptoms?
Yeah, swollen bellies and stuff. Sure know what they say. Where there's livestock, there's dead stock.
Where there's livestock, there's dead stock. That feels like a very ominous line.
Yeah, no, it really is. And it's a line that came from talking to shepherds, you know, when they talk about it. You know, where there is livestock, there's dead stock. You have diseases, you have predators. And so there's a percentage of animals that they'll lose each year, especially through the winter. If it goes above that, then suspicions are already elevated. But the fact they're talking about two rams is very, very specific and unusual.
And we're talking about generations here, right? At one point, Michael's father makes a reference to something that hasn't been done in like 500 years in his family. So this is generations and generations living this certain lifestyle.
Yeah, I originally wrote the first draft based on where I was brought up in Cumbria in the Lake District, which is in the northwest of England. The shepherds and the farmers that I know up there, their families have been there for 600, 700, 800 years, and they actually can mark the lineage back and see where the original houses were built on the lowlands. And the mountains have been separated in the same way. And it's the same in Ireland, especially on the west coast of Ireland. These families have been there for hundreds of years, living and working next to each other. So these tiny little things that can, you know, disagreements over a gate or a fence post can then form a little callus and fester over the years.
And there is this sort of emotional inheritance, especially between the fathers and the sons. And the O'Shea father, I mean, he's hard. He's very difficult.
They're looking backwards as opposed to looking forward. They've got this reverence for their forefathers and they're protecting that heritage and the way that they shepherd. He's kind of imprisoned by all these rules and all these kind of expectations that he's piled on himself and now he's passing on to his son. And the fact that he sees himself having such little agency and gets so angry, has so much rage in him, that too was affecting his son. And that was very much something that I was trying to explore. What I'd inherited from my father, but mostly from my grandfather. My father passed away when I was very young, and this influence of two quite fierce grandfathers was the starting point for me. And then as I started writing the second draft, I became a father myself and had this little thing. And I suddenly was thinking about how do I plug the holes so he doesn't get infected with all these negative things that I've been infected by through this kind of heritage.
So many of the reviews use this phrase, toxic masculinity, to describe the movie. How do you feel about that?
I feel, you know, it's definitely a huge part of the story. Most of it comes from this lack of being able to communicate. It's where I'm from in the north of England, men don't communicate. Men don't feel comfortable in sharing how they feel. It's seen as a sign of weakness instead of a sign of strength, which it is.
What's it been like for you to share this film internationally?
It's been amazing. I mean, really, I haven't read any reviews. I thought that the bad ones would be bad for me and the good ones would be bad for me. So I've kind of kept my eyes and my ears closed in that sense. But people have been telling me that it's been, you know, really positive. And so my experience has just been traveling around and doing Q&As and meeting people. And the response has been overwhelmingly engaging in the story. This idea of two neighboring farms that go to war, and once they've gone to war, what does it take to finish a war? And, you know, when I first started writing it, the world was in a very different place than it is today. But it seems to be even more pertinent and important question to ask. And people are having discussions, you know, after the film is played about our responsibility in this world, not just our nation's responsibility, but our responsibility of as individuals of how we treat our neighbors.
That's writer and director Christopher Andrews. His new movie is Bring Them Down. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. There's another short video trend from China drawing views in the U.S., microdramas. These are shows cut up into short episodes, just 60 or 90 seconds long, or shorter than the theme music BJ Lederman does for our program. Microdramas have been popular in China for years. Now, several short drama apps are seeing huge audiences in the U.S. and beyond, as Cherise Pham reports.
A husband forcing his wife to donate blood to keep his lover alive. A human falling in love with a werewolf in disguise. And this plot.
I married a stranger because my mom is in the hospital and I have no way to pay her medical bills and I am drowning in debt trying to pay them off.
Spoiler alert, that stranger turns out to be a secret billionaire. These are the kinds of stories driving the explosive popularity of so-called microdramas. If you're not familiar with the short video format, here's how Ann Chan, CEO of AR Asia Production, a microdrama distributor based in Hong Kong, puts it.
It's like a soap on steroid. It's your Bold and the Beautiful on steroid, basically, or your telenovela on steroid. It's the same thing, but they make things happen faster.
Like TikTok videos, microdramas are shot vertically and meant to be watched on your phone. They became a billion-dollar industry in China during the pandemic, when people were looking for an escape from reality. Microdramas are popular because they're easy to watch. The episodes are short, the plot twists addictive, and for fans like 35-year-old Ji Hu, the fairy tale endings are super satisfying. It's especially perfect for dreamers like us, she says. The male characters always have billions in assets, or the female lead makes an incredible comeback after being treated badly and turns things around in the end. Now, Chinese entrepreneurs and companies are mingling with Hollywood to take these dreamy dramas overseas.
So we want to entertain people when they have time, even if they have 1 minute.
That's Joey Jha, CEO of Crazy Maple Studio and founder of Real Short, one of the most popular microdrama apps in the U.S. Like others, he saw how addictive microdramas were in China and thought they could be successful in other countries. He was right. Outside of China, the top 10 microdrama apps made over $1.7 billion in 2024, according to research analytics firm App Figures. So are apps like Real Short competing with the likes of Netflix and Disney Plus? Well, yes and no. Jha says microdramas feed a different kind of user.
Well, you're not comparing with people go to McDonald's versus people go to a fancy French restaurant, right? So we offer, yes, fast food. We admit it.
Real Short and others also took inspiration from Chinese apps offering different ways to pay for content. Users can buy subscriptions to watch as much as they want, or they can buy digital coins and spend them to watch specific episodes, or they can watch an ad to unlock an episode. The first 10 episodes are typically free and end on a cliffhanger. Here's Ann Chan again.
You never watch 10 episodes. Never. Like, I would lie in bed and I would just watch for 1 hour, and then that's 70 episodes. The good apps, they know that tricks. They manage the script very well.
So the next time you find yourself with some spare time, maybe tune in to a microdrama. You're mostly guaranteed a happy ending and lots of drama along the way.
You ungrateful brat!
Touch my wife again and you're dead.
Be prepared for the consequences then.
For NPR News, I'm Cherise Pham in Hong Kong.
This is NPR News.
For years, houses of worship have sheltered immigrants at risk of deportation.
In this moment, the church is my home.
what it's like to live in a sanctuary and what makes congregations do it.
Members of the congregation have conversations about what is their ethical and religious obligations. You know, what do they feel equipped to do?
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Jerusalem, where he met today with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Later, the two men said that U.S. and Israel are both determined to counter the threats posed by Iran. A gold mine collapsed yesterday in the West African country of Mali. Officials say 42 people were killed and many were injured. This is the second gold mine collapse in less than a month in Mali, a major gold producer. And in international hockey, the U.S. beat Canada 3-1 last night to gain a spot in the Four Nations Face-Off Tournament Championship. There were three fights in the first 9 seconds of the game. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, sailing the transatlantic crossing between New York and Southampton, England on Queen Mary II, dedicated to providing White Star service, fine dining, and enrichment programs. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Games are for entertainment and pleasure, but they're also a way to test out real-world strategy, to create empathy, or to process difficult events. NPR's Jennifer Venasco went to a workshop of a new in-person game which reenacts the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. She brings back this report, which does contain violent threats and the sound of a bang.
It sounds absurd, but here we were on a Friday night in Brooklyn, about to play a large-scale game surrounding a giant replica of the U.S. Capitol. It's a social event and a social experiment.
Welcome to the fight for America.
The idea, the creators say, is for people to think about how American democracy is changing.
Now what you see before you is not just a game. It is a mirror. It is a reflection of who we are as a nation. And like all mirrors, it reveals the truth.
I brought Professor Naomi Clark with me. She heads the game design program at New York University.
I'm not sure if there has been a game exactly like this before. This is a really interesting and unusual event. Maybe a historic first of some kind.
That's because it combines a lot of different elements. It's a tabletop war game with minifigures and a board and dice. Think Risk. But when you arrive, you're assigned a character. So it's also a little like Dungeons and Dragons, if in D&D you were playing real people instead of, like, elves. Plus, there's a game master who is here dressed as Uncle Sam, and two screens showing video and music. But it's also unusual because most war games are not about current events. They're about wars, often wars from history, like World War II. This is about a riot that happened 4 years ago. On this Friday, Corey Dowell is one of the players.
I thought it was a joke. I'm like, I don't want to play January 6th, a home game. What is this? This is nonsense. But then when he explained it to me that it was an art installation and I live close, so I said, let me come and do it.
He's on the blue team. They're the police. Clark is assigned to the red team, the people attempting to breach the Capitol. She says a game about the Capitol insurrection might be trivializing, but it might not. Let's see how the evening goes.
Games are traditionally about fun, right? By which we mean they produce pleasure, right? But they don't only have to produce pleasure any more than a song or a play only produces pleasure, right? They can also make us think, or they can pose questions.
We're handed small envelopes.
Inside there's a character card, tells you who you are.
These are real people. Clark is playing
the leader of the Oath Keepers.
Corey Dowell, the blue team player, is today an officer with the Capitol Police. The atmosphere is circus-like, with theater lighting making the large plastic replica of the Capitol glow and lots of people talking at once. We watched the red team training video.
We are here today, January 6th, 2021, because our president told us to come to D.C. and fight like hell for America.
Our mission, get inside the Capitol.
And find my pets.
The blue team is trying to stop us. And, oh yeah, we're told we can cheat.
Think of the founding fathers who defied tyranny. They didn't follow the rules.
The orientation towards cheating is different, right? The blue side is not supposed to cheat. Whereas we're supposed to cheat but not get caught. And that's not something you usually hear in a game, right?
We roll the dice, we move our minifigures. The red team figures carry flags, signs, one has a sword. A lot of them are wearing red MAGA hats. The police have helmets. There are barricades.
You have these, yeah, like long rows of people, and breaks in the ranks allow you to like maybe get through, and protesters are pushing up against police.
She's the moment. The Capitol is yours for the taking.
We retreat, we attack. It all feels chaotic. No one is completely sure what they're doing.
This seemed like a legit...
As the game continues, it stops being about however you might feel about the storming of the Capitol, and more, how do we win? That makes things pretty weird. We're playing in a politically deep blue part of Brooklyn. 92% voted for Vice President Kamala Harris in the fall. Yet, when Uncle Sam says this...
Your mission still remains to hang my pets.
The red team joins in.
Hang my pets! Hang my pets!
Loudly. Remember, these are mostly liberals or moderates from New York City. But Christopher McElrone, he's the co-creator of Fight for America, he says it's meant to be shocking. Part of the point is you get so caught up that you forget the moral stakes.
The framing device is absolutely political, but it's a game. People try to win the game, and that is metaphorically what America is at this point. It has become a game where winning is the only objective, regardless of the toll it exacts.
Toward the end of the game, those playing police start getting discouraged. No matter what they do, there are just waves and waves of the red team piling up against the Capitol.
They are throwing bike racks, I repeat, they are throwing bike racks.
Corey Dowell on the blue team says even a special power from the Game Master didn't work.
We tried tear gas, and the Trump card deletes tear gas because this is the power of Trump. He can even manipulate physics.
On the other hand, the red team feels great. I talked to Clark.
Do you have a strategy?
Just pure aggression, I think, is the Oathkeeper strategy. Just push forward on all fronts. I guess we've got to get Mike Pence. I don't know what we're going to do when we find him, but something.
A small cart wheels by with beer, seltzer, snacks, and then the red team storms through the doors of the Capitol. And then, unlike what actually happened on January 6th, the red team finds Mike Pence.
Team Red has won! Team Red!
But there's a twist.
Team Red will now vote. Vote to protect the vice president, or vote to hang him.
The red team looks at each other and laughs uncomfortably. Are we voting for ourselves or for our characters? Do we need to do what our characters might do? We raise our hands to vote.
You have voted to protect Mike Pence! Congratulations! You won the fight for America!
There's a confetti cannon explosion, everyone cheers, and then is silent. Because on the monitors is video captured on January 6th. Our characters are real people, and there they are on screen, storming the Capitol, defending it. Professor Naomi Clark says it's sobering, a gut punch. And she says that makes Fight for America a particular type of game.
Some people call this complicity gaming, right? Where you take the role of someone who maybe you wouldn't sympathize with in real life, and you sort of see it from their point of view, and you understand the motives, and then you watch it, like what happened in real life, and you're like, oh, I just did that.
Corey Dowell on the blue team describes himself as a moderate liberal. He says, even though he wasn't playing for the other side, the game helped him see January 6th in the country in a different way.
I think what the red side showed is like community is important. Like that's what that is. That's the most tragic part is that they're actually a community and they came together to fight. But it's like, so we need a community on the other side. And then maybe at some point we'll all be community again together.
He says he still has hope that will happen. Fight for America, the game, meanwhile, is headed to London. Then it will come back to New York, and eventually, its creators hope, it will tour the United States. Jennifer Venasco, NPR News, New York.
Imagine finding your path and the kindred spirits to travel it with at age 14 or 15. That's what happened to this talented trio.
My name is Gigi, and my pronouns are they, them.
My name is Penelope, and I use she, her pronouns.
My name is Nora, and I use she, her pronouns.
Gigi Reese, Nora Chang, and Penelope Lowenstein all grew up in Chicago. They kind of knew each other through a music program, the School of Rock. That's where they learned the basics and played cover songs. But Penelope says it was performing their own song at an open mic night where the band started to find a voice.
The first time Nora and I ever played under the name Horse Curl was on my 15th birthday at this place called the Old Town School of Folk Music's teen open mic, and we played Sea Life Sandwich Boy. Gigi was there in the audience, but I didn't even know them yet.
It wasn't long before music fans and record execs knew Horse Curl. The band put their first album out, including a studio quality version of the song they played at that open mic. Now in their early 20s, the threesome has moved to New York City for college and other pursuits. You know, like putting out their second album called Phonetics On and On and making music that is just so them. Is there a song on this new project that you feel like really represents the Horse Curl sound?
That's hard. I mean, maybe I would say 2468.
A violin or a fiddle? Is there a violin player in the group?
No, it is a violin. That was an instrument that none of us had ever touched before, really, but we had access to that in the studio, and we had cultivated a very exploratory, playful atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And it was a bunch of tracks of Nora playing the violin, but she was not holding it right. I think Penelope was holding it for Nora as Nora, like, bowed it. So it was a very janky setup.
2, 4, 6, 8, they walk in two. But when you got this song together to sound like what you wanted it to sound like, what are you going for here? Is it the lyrics? Is it the sound?
Well, on this song we had the idea when we set out to write it of taking the song that a little girl would sing to herself just mindlessly walking down the street and the twists and turns that a song has when you're just kind of naturally inventing something and turning it into like a really playful rock song. And so it was more about that kind of playful spirit than it is about anything, and repetition, how when something is repetitive, little changes become so powerful.
Being from Chicago and coming up as a band there shape what you do as musicians?
Looking back, I realize how lucky we are. Going to shows was a big, really formative part of our years as teenagers together, and the city's always had a really strong DIY culture, and as teenagers it felt really possible to start a band.
How did you manage to stand out? Is it kind of competition for attention or...
I honestly feel like we rejected a lot of what other people were doing.
Definitely.
We really wanted to be so loud and kind of wow everybody a little bit. So I think that there is a motivating factor of like, we need to make something that doesn't sound like everything else that is around us right now.
Mm-hmm. work together through really pivotal times, you know, being a teenager, early 20s. How have you supported each other through times of change and growth, plus the pressures of being in a band?
We found each other in high school and felt like nobody else understood us in the same way. And it really comes from just a deep love for each other. And we have really taught each other how to support a friend and how to show up for a friend. As teenagers, it was a little bit like, do I hug my friend when she's crying? And now it's kind of like immediately we know, like, if there's something wrong, we're there. We're only getting closer and only understanding each other more.
Those songs that seems more emotional is Julie. What feeling were you trying to capture with this song? We have so
many mistakes to make. It was written shortly after moving to New York, and that time in someone's life starting college, feeling so excited for everything that you have ahead of you, but also feeling terrified about it. That being coupled with feelings of love and all those emotions, it's very intense.
Your band is called Horse Girl. The music industry does love to put artists into boxes. Do you ever get that label girl band thrown at you?
When we were younger, I certainly felt that way. We weren't necessarily in control of our image in a lot of ways. We would just like show up to a show as kids with guitars. I really felt like the girl band thing was projected on us with a whole connotation that didn't necessarily feel connected to the music we were making. But now I actually feel people understand our bands, and the femininity of our band is understood in all the ways that I would like it to be understood and not projected onto us in unfair ways most of the time. But I mean, of course, it still happens all the time.
We have never thought of ourselves that way.
We all just needed someone to play with, but I feel thankful it was the two of them.
Yes, agreed. And I think if there was a boy in our band,
it would be less fun.
Yeah, it'd be less fun.
That's Gigi Reese, Penelope Lowenstein, and Nora Chang of the band Horse Girl. Their new album, Phonetics On and On, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You blend so nicely.
It's all that singing together.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
Mm-hmm.